So my primary introduction to Star Trek when I began to be able to make my own media choices was through books. I was thinking about this a very, very long time ago, for I am an old person, but this would be the mid to late 70s, and at the time, my dad had a friend, a buddy named Tom Betancourt, or by his pen name T. Ernesto Betancourt, and he's an author. He actually wrote quite a few what would today be called YA novels and a couple of science fiction-y themed novels, including one I think called Tune In Tomorrow, which had a time travel theme. And there was also one of his early books called The Mortal Instruments, which is about a kid from the barrio who gets essentially taken over by an alien intelligence, and in turn, that combined synthetic organism takes over a major defense organization's computer and threatens the safety of the world. Spoilers. It's a book published in 1977, so you know, if you haven't read it yet. But anyway, this book was given to me at a young age. I think I actually had a galley of it because, again, the author was a friend of my dad's, and I really loved it. And I started consuming more science fiction and speculative fiction at the time. So I was a big Isaac Asimov fan. I was a big Robert Heinlein fan. I read a lot of Larry Niven, but also I read a lot of Star Trek. I had David Gerald's book about the writing and creation of The Trouble with Tribbles, and I probably read that book three or four times before I ever saw the actual episode. And I was fascinated with some of the process, the behind the scenes of creating that television program. Someone had given me, it might have been that same Tom Betancourt, had given me copies of the Starfleet Technical Manual and the Starfleet Medical Manual, which were these large sort of faux, they were intended to be the Starfleet reference documents, and they looked like they might have fit nicely into a binder that would be under Scotty's desk in engineering, or in a cabinet in sick bay. And they were like, you know, you read these books and it was, you know, what's the Tellarian biology, you know, why you discover that Vulcan urine is toxic to plants. I mean, all sorts of just bizarre.
It's always good to know.
Yeah, just and the kind of stuff that I think that Michael Okuda was responsible for in later instantiations, later editions of Trek, but just creating all of the canon or all of the Bible, some of this stuff, and there were little sort of out of world, out of context notes in some places in the book, but you got the sense that this was stuff that the writers were using to do their job in crafting the episodes. And so I had those books for a long time. I mean, they were some of my favorite books. And then I started getting the original, I think the log 1 through log 10 series of novelizations, which I did not realize, possibly not until this morning when I was looking at it, that they were actually based on the animated series. I didn't know that's where they came from. I think I might have known it and forgotten it, But those were great little, you know, science fiction nuggets. One of my favorites is the How Much for Just the Planet, and there were a couple others in that series. Alan Dean Foster, of course, who wrote that wonderful Splinter of the Mind's Eye, and many other Star Wars and other mythology centric novels. So Alan Dean Foster was responsible for novel animated series scripts into books. So he did incredible work. And there was a Larry Niven one. Larry Niven's story, I think the story is called The Soft Weapon, which was about an ancient weapon discovered by some Kazin, which are the big furry cat-like aliens in Niven's Known Space. So there was a Star Trek animated series episode that was based on this, that Larry Niven wrote the script for, that was based on his story about this entire other race of aliens who never show up in Star Trek anywhere else. So basically, Known Space and the Star Trek universe are in some ways the same universe if you take the animated series as canon. So that to me, just like, whoa, oh my God, it's like Tommy Westfall universe collapsing in on itself. But all that said, so then it was more of the, you know, I think Jason mentioned the Vonda McIntyre books. There were also the Sandra Marshak and Myrna Culbreth possibly the two best sci-fi author names of all time. They wrote a lot of books, and those were the Ballantine and Pocket books. And I had, until I gave them away probably 6 or 7, maybe 8 years ago, I had a shelf full of paperbacks that were all of these novelizations and all the books from that were based on the series, and most of them based on the original series. Eventually started buying them in the next generation. So it was almost entirely through reading that I became engaged in Star Trek fandom, and then later watched the original series and got to know the characters in that way. I mean, of course, I was aware of it and I had seen the occasional episode, but I wasn't a fanatic watcher of the series. And then the Next Generation. So, you know, I can take a breath and we can talk about that.
Well, I just think it's fascinating that your first foray into Star Trek fandom was through the novelizations of episodes that you didn't even know were going on. That's great. And I remember, this reminds me of a summer I spent in my youth. One of my friends, I was sitting in one of my friends' den. You know, we didn't have anything to do. It was summertime, just sitting there, and his father had all his books on shelves in the den, obviously, and I was looking up, and I saw this whole shelf full of Star Trek novels. And at that point, I was a Star Trek fan, but I did not realize that they were Star Trek novels. And I was also a big reader, and I was like, how did this escape my attention? So for the rest of that summer, I borrowed all of those books from him, and I just read them all. And How Much for Just the Planet was one of those books, and yep. That one sticks with me just because it was such a wacky, wacky story.
It was crazy. And I was in a phase of cleaning or of, you know, putting away childish things. I gave a satchel full of these books to a coworker some years ago. So Tim Dunphy, if you're listening, I would love to borrow those back. I don't keep them. I'm not going to take them from you, but I would love to have a little taste of my childhood back and have a chance to reread them. I'm sure they're mostly on the Kindles or the iBooks now, but there's something about those crumbly paperbacks and they were pulp. I mean, they were my generation's expression of like a Raymond Chandler or a Mickey Spillane. They were pulp novels, mm-hmm. and they were not meant as high literature. But to me, they were just I consumed them. I didn't read them. I devoured them.
You and me both. And the covers were great. Oh, those books bring back so many memories. Maybe I should start another podcast where I pick a random Star Trek novel.
and all 8 people who enjoy listening to that will be so passionate.
Exactly. It's a gold mine, I tell you.
Also, what's interesting about that scene is that earlier in the episode, in the open, we have Geordi telling Data a joke, actually just telling him the end of a joke, is all we see of it. And Data trying to, apparently it's a dirty joke, which is fascinating.
Right on the bridge.
right out there on the bridge. And you know, the chief HR officer is nowhere to be found. So Data doesn't get it and is trying to process that humor. And this is my moment to say, thank God for Brent Spiner, because you cannot imagine – it's very hard for me to imagine Next Generation without his performance really at the heart of it. Surprisingly enough, the emotional heart of it, given that he is playing an emotionless android. But just just the wonderful – even early – even in the first season, the wonderful grace notes and the kind of taking it right up to the line of parody in that performance without stepping over, and just everything being just kind of right with the way he plays Data is wonderful to me. Now, I will say that what doesn't work in this particular episode is that they're going through this whole thing with humor and how Data doesn't get humor and how he doesn't get the swimming in moonlight thing. And that's the whole opening scene. So then when he's sitting with the computer and he's looking at all this data, he says, intriguing. And he's like talking to himself. And the computer interrupts, like asks him if it was a command, and he's talking again. He's so excited that he was talking to himself, and he starts explaining to the computer what it's about, and the computer stops him.
It's like, yeah,
it's like, I got it,
Data, thanks. I'm a giant computer. I understand what you're talking about.
And just the, like, okay, we have the same character who minutes before could not grok humor, but now completely understands that he is being made sport of by another computer.
It's
and is like giving the
moment.
Computer stink eye. And that's like, it's like that. Yeah, I get why you're doing it from a comedy perspective in the episode, but it makes no sense for the character at all.
The Enterprise computer, I would say, is a character in the show, and that is out of character for that character, right? No other instance does the computer talk back and say, okay, enough.
I'm over it.
That's right. Let's move on.
Very strange. But, it is a nice... It's a nice opportunity for Data to do something fun and important for the crew, and it also, again, as we move forward, the question of whether in this entire plot Data would have been able to break the plot open, because of course he would not be corruptible / controllable.
Right, he would be the one man one assumes who
one which does happen in. There's a future episode where his off switch or his on off switch comes into play. You know what it is? It's the game. It's Ashley Judd and
that's right, yeah.
Because again, his androidness and his inability to be controlled as we mortals of flesh would be comes into play. But that does not actually happen, except for a brief mention. It doesn't happen in this episode.
And so Geordi's fine. He has a he quips, if I could see, I'd be seeing stars.
Jeez. So a little bit of gallows humor from Geordi there.
Yes, I'm like, oh man.
way to drag the mood down, dude.
By the way, I'm blind, in case anyone has forgotten.
And one of my series that I currently watch on network television is The Blacklist, the James Spader show. And I watched that show today thinking, wow, this show includes quite a bit of graphic violence, what I consider graphic violence. And I am often taken a little bit aback by the amount of gore that is on a show that is on network television. And then I watched this scene. I was like, no, wait a minute. I've forgotten so much.
And not that this is an unusual amount of graphic violence for the time and for the show itself, for Star Trek, right? Because you're not expecting this kind of thing. Generally, people in Star Trek disintegrate or get knocked out. They don't blow up and then bloodily coalesce into a giant, strange monster. It is unusual. So it was shocking on a number of levels. And even rewatching it, I knew it was going to happen, but I was still like, whoa.
Yeah,
it's effective.
It's quite effective. It is a substantial amount of gore. And I, as I said at the top of the show, or possibly before we started recording the show, this is an episode that had a big impact on me when I first watched it, because it did freak me out. It was creepy. It was... at least modestly effective in terms of conveying the we don't know who's on our side and anybody could be anybody effect of the conspiracy. And of course it ends or the penultimate scene is this incredibly graphic destruction of the mother alien, which they presume, they have the evidence that the people who they knew about who are being controlled are released, but they don't know for sure that everyone's been released. And it just is a very... It's a very kind of scary, scary trope, a scary idea that people can be controlled and that you never know who you're dealing with. It seems to me that this is the sort of thing that probably happens in Starfleet all the time.
It does seem to happen a little too often.
Yeah, because there's all sorts of crazy mind controlling aliens out there, and we have not, we have not seen the last of. While we may have seen the last of this particular brand of cerebral parasite, we have certainly not seen the last of attempts by third parties to control, redirect, and affect what's going on in Starfleet. And why not? Because Starfleet obviously is an incredibly powerful, dangerous organization. And if your interests do not align with those of the Federation or those of the human race, you've got to deal with Starfleet. So it's completely understandable that this is something that would happen frequently. It's just very disturbing that it does. That's
true. And hopefully, after this incident, Starfleet put in some protocols that made the medical checks, the scans, that kind of thing.
You know they didn't. You know they didn't.
They didn't, but they should have.